Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Dr. Robert L. Sutton is the author of Good Boss, Bad Boss, How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst, and many previous books, including his national bestseller, The No Asshole Rule, which won a Quill Award for the best business book in 2007. He's also a professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School. He's consulted with numerous Fortune 500 companies, including IBM, McDonald's, and Procter & Gamble. He's been recently featured in the New York Times, Business Week, Wall Street Journal, and on Today, NPR, BBC, PBS, CNN, CNBC, Fox, and Marketplace. He's written well over 100 articles for such publications as Business Week, the Harvard Business Review, the Financial Times, Esquire UK, and McKinsey Quarterly. Bob, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, Bob, what are some of the qualities of a good boss?
I think the question that just about every boss should start with is, do I know what it feels like to work for me, or am I deluding myself or living in a fool's paradise? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence that the most effective bosses are very much in tune with the way their actions and their words affect the people who work for them. And they're also aware that the people who work for them watch them very closely. This is something that not only happens with humans, it happens with apes. The alpha male in a baboon troop gets looked at by the other more junior members of the troop every 20 or 30 seconds. Mm. It's not quite that bad when you're the boss, but when you're the boss, the people are watching you very closely. Even the little moves you make get magnified. So there's that part. But the second part that makes it difficult is that being a boss, being in a position of power over others, makes you being virtually all human beings, remarkably oblivious to what they're doing. Mm-hmm. We've got a series of experiments that show that when you give people power, they tend to focus more on their own needs and less on the needs of others. And then there's, in organizations very often, an enormous amount of filtering. Bad news as it goes up the chain of command. Everybody puts a little positive spin because they don't want to deliver bad news to their boss.
Of course not.
There's a great story. Mm-hmm. Richard Feynman, who was the Nobel Prize winner in physics and was also heavily involved in the investigation of the Challenger explosion, asked the engineers on the ground, what's the likelihood that the main engine would fail on the space shuttle? Something which hasn't happened yet and never happened, but he asked them what the odds were. And they said 1 in 200 or 1 in 300. Then when he went to the top of the NASA chain of command and he asked them that, they said the odds were 1 in 100,000. It shows that when you're the boss, there's a whole bunch of things that make you out of touch with reality, and you've got to be aware of it.
Okay, and the subtitle of the book is How to Be the Best and Learn from the Worst. Mm-hmm. But how can leaders do that?
Just because you're a boss, and you may think that you're not overbearing, nasty, incompetent in some ways, don't trust your own judgments, because we're all remarkably poor judges of ourselves, especially in complex tasks. There's a lot of evidence to support that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. It's interesting. I was teaching a group of executives, right, and I gave them this little exercise. Let's make a list of the characteristics of the worst possible boss. Mm-hmm. You've got to come up with 50 characteristics. And I'm giving you 7 minutes, and they looked at me like I was nuts, and they all did it. Everything from overbearing to dishonest, micromanaging, disorganized, being a flake.
And what exactly did that suggest?
The message there, and this is from Eleanor Roosevelt, is it's easier to learn from the mistakes of others because we can't live long enough to make all those mistakes. And I think that having a bad boss has one of two effects. One is you start imitating them or become like them, or you learn what not to do. Mm-hmm. My last book was on how to avoid jerks. And so I got literally thousands of emails. And I got an email from a guy who was a senior surgeon at a large hospital. And he said, when I was in medical school, those of us who were residents would get together every week and keep a book of the jerk of the week, the attending physician who was the biggest jerk that week. And they all promised one another that when they were the attendings, they wouldn't act that way. And he said, we have tried to monitor each other over the years. And that shows the kind of self-awareness these folks have. And they're trying to learn from the mistakes or the failures of others.
Exactly. That's interesting. Do you have anything you want to add?
Sure. There's these things called after-action reviews, which are quite famous in the management area. Mm-hmm. They were started in the military where they'll have a field exercise and then they'll have a quick debrief of what happened. There has been some research done in the Israeli military that shows that people learn more from failures than from successes. But there also was an interesting twist in that research, which is the best way to learn from successes is to talk about, well, I know things went great overall, but what were some of the things we could have done even better? What are some of the little mistakes we made? And the reason that the researchers who did this thought that was so effective is that when there's failure, there's all this negative emotion. Uh-huh. But when you talk about failures that occur in the context of successes, you're not feeling so defensive.
Right.
There is an argument in some related research that a good way to learn is to look for your successes in your failures and failures in your successes. And the reason you look for successes in your failures is that you're already upset because you're failed and it calms you down a little.
Sure.
And there can be grains of things that people do right, even though they're not overall successful.
Now, in the book, you pointed out that most great bosses divide their work relentlessly between two major goals, performance or humanity.
Right.
Or they try to combine the two.
Yes. One thing to emphasize, first of all, I could make a pretty strong empirical case that treating people with some dignity and some respect will increase the odds that you will be more successful. If you want an example that's in the news, there's this company which has factories in China that produce iPods, Dell computers, IBM computers, and apparently they're treating the workers badly enough that many of them are committing suicide. Mm. So they went so far below the humanity bar that it's messing them mm-hmm. up financially.
Well, that's true.
They've now raised their pay. They're trying to have therapists on site. Mm-hmm. But that statement about performance and humanity is, for me, also a value statement.
Right. Now, could you go deeper on that for us?
The notion that the only measure of effectiveness is the amount of money you make or the number of games you win is just a set of capitalist values. Mm-hmm. You can make more money than anybody in your industry, and you can win more games than any coach who has ever existed. Bob Knight, who is the winningest coach in college basketball history, being a good example. But if you're a jerk, in my book, you're still incompetent as a human being. And I think it's possible to value both at the same time.
Right.
There are times probably when you have to sacrifice humanity for performance and performance for humanity.
Can you give us an example?
Mm-hmm. One of the most humane and effective executives I know is David Kelly. David started an innovation firm called IDEO, one of the most famous firms, using a model, the way he puts it, love and money.
Okay.
And the way he describes it is, there's times when he's got to show people love and treat them with dignity, give them work they feel great about, give them time off, whatever. But then there's times when he's got to bring in the money. And what he's figured out over time is he likes to build up the love points because he knows he's going to have to burn them later for capitalist purposes. But then there'll be a point where he's burned so many and everybody's being grouchy. He's losing good people. He's got to back off and give them interesting projects, stop taking new clients, go around and show them love and appreciation.
Right.
So being a good boss is this balancing act where you've got to be in tune with your people. And I think the solution to balancing is you've got to make the adjustment over time. And one of my favorite sayings is time was invented so you don't have to do everything all at once. So I think that's a lot of a boss's job.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about what best bosses do. For example, in the book, you talk about the issue of control and blame setting.
There's some interesting research on what sort of bosses, especially CEOs, are viewed as most effective over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. There's very strong empirical laboratory studies and field studies. And it turns out that despite the human tendency and sometimes the advice from the lawyers to point fingers at other people, bosses who take both credit and blame tend to be viewed as more competent and lead higher performing organizations.
Mm, interesting.
So here's the argument about why this is the case. When you're a boss or in a leadership position, your main problem is convincing people you're in control. And people understand mm-hmm. that people are going to make mistakes, but if you have the power to wreck something, you have the power to fix it. There's also growing literature in the legal world that shows that when people say they made a mistake and they're sorry, they do better. And where you're really seeing this happening is litigation around medical mistakes.
Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Sure.
For instance?
And the University of Michigan is one of the hospitals that's been doing this for several years. And they figured out that when doctors make mistakes, if they apologize and then quickly try to settle with the family, not only does everybody feel better emotionally, they actually cost them less money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But when you make a mistake and you won't apologize, it shows that you're not willing to learn.
Absolutely.
The basic formula, if you're a boss, is you don't just say, I screwed up, I'm sorry. You say, I messed up, I'm sorry. Here's what I learned. Here's the steps I'm taking to fix it. And you pull people in at every step.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. To give you an example, there's an incident that happened in Canada. This is 2008. There's a company there called Maple Leaf Foods. They make processed meats. And they've got a CEO named Michael McCain. What happened was they had some tainted meats that were tainted with listeria, form of bacteria, and about 20 people died.
Ooh.
Now, Michael McCain stood up at a press conference, said, it's our fault. It's our responsibility. We're doing everything we can to fix it. When the press asked him if the government inspectors were to blame, he said, no, this is our responsibility.
Yeah.
And what they did is they shut down the plant, and they very quickly gave people a level of transparency that was absolutely unbelievable. And they would always show the press where they were making progress. And it's this notion, we had the power to break it, we had the power to fix it. He also declined advice from his lawyers to avoid contact with the victims, and in fact, settled with most of the victims by the end of the year.
Right.
Compare that to the typical litigation. And the other thing that amazed me is Maple Leaf sales are back. Their reputation's better than it was before they killed 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
Compare that to the way that most executives or managers respond to even minor mistakes. It's a very interesting case.
Right, right. Now, in the book, you also talk about smart talk.
Yes. This comes from my first management book was with another Stanford professor, Jeff Pfeffer. It was called The Knowing-Doing Gap.
Mm-hmm.
The main idea of The Knowing-Doing Gap was there are many situations where people or groups of people know which things their organization should be doing, but there's something about the system they're part of that makes it difficult or impossible to turn knowledge into action.
Right.
One thing that we discovered was there are many situations, and some organizations make this work, where people are paid for saying smart things rather than doing smart things. And it's, of course, easier to say something smart, and it takes longer to actually turn it into action. And to give you an example from my own university.
Go ahead.
I'm involved in a new program called the D School.
Right.
The concept of the Stanford D School is we have our students and groups go out and try to find prototype solutions to virtually everything. One group designed a new sleeping bag device that's like an incubator for third world countries. That's much more important than anything of my students ever did. But one of the things that one of my student groups did was work on trying to improve bike safety at the Stanford campus. There's a lot of bike crashes on the Stanford campus, and there's one place mm-hmm. where the students are always smashing into each other, and the students call it the intersection of death. What we did, we had 50 students, and we said, you have 48 hours to do something to improve bike safety on campus, not to talk about it, but to do it. So one group literally walked in without anybody's permission, and they set up a roundabout, and it worked for like 2 hours. So it turned out that Stanford put a roundabout there. 4 years after this one day demonstration,
mm-hmm.
we went and talked to the person who was in charge of bike safety at campus and said, why didn't you put it in place? Wasn't it a good idea? And his answer was, that was my idea. I had the idea first.
Hmm.
When you dig into the logic of that, in his mind, he had the idea. That was enough.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Obviously, there are many impediments to action. One is some organizations will actually reward smart talk and not smart actions. So you've got to make sure mm-hmm. what your reward system is doing. Another one is that an MBA education, I think, very often teaches how to talk about management, but not how to actually do it. So people may actually lack the skills.
Right.
Related to that, it turns out that one of the best predictors of how successful an organization is whether or not the senior executives understand the business they're running. You look at people like Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, Bill Gates, the guys who started Pixar, John Lasseter, and Ed Catmull.
Yep.
Two other examples would be Meg Whitman, who's now running for governor in the state of California, and Anne Mulcahy, who just stepped down as CEO of Xerox.
Mm-hmm.
They have massively different management styles. But the thing that those leaders have in common is they understand and have deep knowledge of the work they manage.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true.
And then the final thing I would emphasize is simplicity. So my favorite recent CEO in probably the entire world, certainly in the U.S. business scene, is A.G. Laffley, who just left Procter & Gamble.
Right.
A.G. is not a particularly exciting CEO, but he's relentlessly patient and is a person who does simple things and says them over and over again.
Right.
So while the meltdown was happening in New York because apparently nobody was smart enough to understand what those brilliant young people in New York and London were doing, A.G. was running a company and his motto was, keep it Sesame Street simple. He would say to 200 audiences a year, over and over again, the customer is boss. There are two moments of truth. The first time the customer encounters the product where they buy it, and then every time they use it. Another one is Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting to see what happened when Jobs took over as acting CEO of Apple.
Yeah.
He'd been acting CEO for less than a year, and he put up a list of all of the computer hardware that Apple was selling. And went on and on and on, about 50 pieces of hardware. And he said, see all these pieces of hardware? Some were good, some were bad. But the problem is, it was so complicated, we couldn't tell our friends which ones to buy. So now we are selling none of them. This was before the iPod or the iPhone.
Of course.
And he went to a simple 2x2 laptop, desktop, home office, 4 computers. And that was about it.
Right.
He went to a straight simplicity model to cut down the product line. So at Apple, you knew that if you weren't contributing to those 4 products, you probably weren't doing anything useful.
Okay. But I'm just curious. To me, looking at this book is like looking at a mirror and forcing yourself to examine your best and worst qualities. Now, would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. And one thing that I would emphasize is, if you look at some of the research, there's been some great national surveys, a Zogby one in particular a few years back, that shows that something like 35% of the workforce reported that at some time or another they've had a bully boss, but only 0.5% reported that they'd ever bullied anyone. The jerks, the bullies, those are the other people. In me, I'm a good person. I could never be a bully.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong with those numbers.
Oh, yes.
They just don't add up. And there's a lot of social psychological research that shows that when you put people in positions of power, they tend to be more focused on their own needs, less focused on the needs of others, and they act like the rules don't apply to them. My favorite little study called the Cookie Study illustrates this, and it's consistent with a couple hundred other studies. It was reported by Deborah Grunfeld and Dr. Keltner, two researchers in the Bay Area, one from Berkeley, one from Stanford. Classic psychology experiment. UC Berkeley undergraduates were brainstorming and then writing a little position paper about how to solve a social problem, global warming, things like that. But the real manipulation was two of them were brainstormers and one of them was the boss randomly assigned to evaluate them. And half an hour into the experiment, the experimenter brought in a plate of 5 cookies. We all know the prohibition against taking the final cookie. So the interesting thing is, well, what happened to the 4th cookie?
Right.
What tended to happen was the people who were in positions of power, the boss, the evaluator, quite consistently took the 4th cookie.
Yeah.
And also the people who were in the positions of power became pigs in other ways. They ate with their mouths open more and they left more crumbs on their little desks. So if you just give people power, it naturally turns them into
jerks. You're exactly right.
Oh, yes.
Now, just to wrap this up.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Is there's a whole bunch of factors, especially the mom effect.
Mm-hmm. So what is that?
People don't like delivering bad news to others. So when you're a boss, you're filtered from it.
Mm-hmm.
One group that always fascinates me are assistants and executive assistants. I'm thinking of one in particular. She did not like to let visitors in who would tend to give bad news to her boss.
Uh-huh. Sure.
Especially the CFO, by the way. And the CFO seems like an important person. And they often do give you bad news. So it'd be very hard for the CFO to get an appointment with the CEO. And she said, well, you know, my job is much easier when he's in a good mood. So anybody who would leave him in a good mood could easily get an appointment. And anybody who would leave him in a bad mood was really hard to get an appointment. And that was one of the things that really struck me. I always thought it was this notion that people are afraid.
Right.
This was just, it was more pleasant having a boss in a good mood. And in fact, the degree to which he was often clueless about what was going on in his company was unbelievable because she was such an effective gatekeeper. The whole system was designed to filter out bad news. But I think that working on our weaknesses, mm-hmm. let alone recognizing them, is something that we as human beings have a hard time doing. And I think this myth that managers or bosses are born and they can't get better is silly, and old dogs can learn new tricks, even CEOs.
We've been speaking to Bob Sutton, author of the new book, Good Boss, Bad Boss. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks, Dave.
Have you attended an AMA webcast? These free one-hour programs deliver practical insight into the latest business issues as well as leadership and management challenges. For a complete schedule of upcoming webcasts, visit the events calendar at amanet.org/events. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.